Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded December 2nd and 3rd, 2023. Well, on November 16th, Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau received a, quote, notice of intention to seek prosecution by the International Criminal Court. Trudeau is one of four Canadian government officials cited in the notice for their complicity in war crimes and crimes against humanity committed by the State of Israel since the commencement of its bombardment of Gaza on October 7th. The notice, issued by the UK-based International Centre of Justice for Palestinians and acted upon by its Canadian associates in the Legal Working Group for Canadian Accountability under the Principles of Universal Jurisdiction, is supported, the ICJP maintains, by, quote, Canada's support of Israel's armed forces where there is demonstrable evidence that international crimes may have already been committed and when there is clear evidence that further crimes against civilians will imminently be perpetrated. Dimitri Lascaris is a Montreal-based activist, journalist, and lawyer. He served as justice critic in the shadow cabinet of the Green Party of Canada and likewise for the Green Party of Quebec. Dimitri's interviews for TRNN are available at therealnews.com, and his articles appear at various sites online, including his website, dimitrilascaris.org. Dimitri Lascaris, in the first half, and in addition to the war crimes being committed in Gaza by Israel, as noted by UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Turk, namely, quote, the collective punishment by Israel of Palestinian civilians and unlawful forcible evacuation of civilians, there is to the matter of the material manner in which Israel's crimes are being committed, specifically the materiel allegedly being used by its military that in themselves constitute crimes. Israel has proven its willingness to use internationally banned weapons like white phosphorus in Gaza in past attacks, and photographic evidence reveals it is doing so now. But what of the generationally destructive depleted uranium? John Helmer is a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. Principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears, Helmer has too been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism, and served as advisor to governments at the highest levels. Among his many book titles are Skripal in Prison, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Jackal's Wedding, American Power, Arab Revolt, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Sovcom Plot, How Pirates Tried to Capture the Treasure of the Russian Seas and Were Caught Out, and his latest released autobiography, Dunce Upon a Time, A Life of Mistakes. John's latest article at Dances with Bears is Biochemical Weapon for Race War. Uranium Warhead Poisoning is the Specialty of U.S. Against Russians, Israel Against Palestinians. John Helmer, and Is Israel Waging an Everlasting Genotoxic War Against Palestine? In the second half. But first, Dimitri Lascaris and seeking justice for Canada's role, aiding and abetting the crime of the century in Gaza. Welcome back to the program, Dimitri.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, it's always my pleasure, of course. Now, Dimitri, the ICJP's Legal Working Group for Canadian Accountability cites, among other statutes, Canada's own Crimes Against Humanity and War Crimes Act, saying that they will present this to the Office of the Prosecutor at the ICC. Dimitri, can you explain first Canada's legal exposure under that act, under its own act, the Crimes Against Humanity and War Crimes Act?
Well, basically what Canada did a number of years ago was it incorporated into the criminal code the provisions, the definitions of war crimes contained in the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court and the principles and concepts contained in the Fourth Geneva Convention, amongst other. The basic, you know, international legal concepts around war crimes and crimes against humanity were incorporated into the criminal code. Now, at the same time, the Canadian government was quite clever about this because it stipulated in the criminal code that in order to prosecute, there would have to be consent given by the Attorney General of Canada, who is appointed by the Prime Minister. So, of course, if a prosecution under the criminal code provisions relating to war crimes and crimes against humanity is contrary to the political objectives, the foreign policies of the government of the day, you're very unlikely to get the consent of the Attorney General to pursue a prosecution. So this poses a considerable legal hurdle within and practical hurdle within Canada itself. The ICC, of course, is another matter. The ICC can act independently of the wishes of the Canadian government. And in fact, it is obliged to do so under its own founding statute if there are grounds to indict. The problem one confronts there is that the current ICC prosecutor, Karim Khan, appears, frankly, and I've said this very loudly and repeatedly on social media and elsewhere, to be a puppet of the West. And I don't believe that he's serious about pursuing any kind of a prosecution of any Western war criminal or any war criminal of a Western ally like Israel. And so we are going to have to be creative as lawyers. Although we should definitely pressure the ICC, we should definitely pressure the Canadian government, absolutely. We as lawyers need to be creative in finding other legal solutions to this quandary.
Well, yeah, I can see the cunning of the Canadian government, and we see it when the RCMP is in charge of investigating itself, for example. But as you say, the Rome Statute is beyond the domestic law of Canada, and this brings in the laws that against war crimes and crimes against humanity that have emanated from Nuremberg on down to the present day. It's funny when I see Israel quoting the bombing of Dresden and so forth as a precedent that they effectively are saying, well, you can't criticize us because this is what you have done. But those bombings were before Nuremberg as well. So, I mean, everything that follows after the Second War and the atrocities committed by all sides in that war, it has to be considered.
Chris, I want to add one thing about that. I'm glad you raised Dresden and the other war crimes committed by the atrocities committed by the Western allies. There's no evidence. Not only did they predate Nuremberg, as you rightly point out, there's no evidence that those mass killings of civilians actually contributed or hastened the end of the war. Absolutely none. What ultimately resulted in victory for the Allies was the destruction of the Nazi military. It wasn't the killing of civilians in Germany or elsewhere. And we need to bear that in mind today. To the extent that Israel is massacring Palestinian civilians, and that's exactly what it's doing, there's no reason to believe that that is going to help it to achieve its stated military objective, which is the destruction of Hamas. And I think Israel understands this perfectly well. Israel's goal ultimately is not to destroy Hamas. I mean, obviously they want to destroy Hamas, but it's much broader than that. And that is they want to ethnically cleanse Gaza of Palestinians, all Palestinians, civilian or otherwise, and they're prepared to commit a genocide in order to achieve that goal. That's what's really going on. So let's just dispense now and once and for all this nonsensical talk about Dresden or the nuking of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The Japanese were on the verge of surrendering at the moment when the Truman administration nuked, incinerated tens of thousands of Japanese children. That was not necessary in order to achieve victory over the Japanese, over its fascist government. So that's very important to bear in mind when we hear all this talk about Dresden.
Yeah, well, and I don't think it's a legal basis that Israel is ultimately, or Netanyahu himself, when they intone those examples. I think what he's trying to say is you and the West have accepted barbarism on a massive scale. And as you rightly say, Dmitry, that the bombing of Dresden was superfluous. It was unnecessary for the war effort. It was malicious, as were the two bombings, the nuclear destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They weren't war aims. They were political aims meant to scare the Russians and to let them know that there was a new world being born with the atomic bomb that only America had at that point. And that was going to usher in what we've come to know as the unipolar world. But yeah. I think this is what Netanyahu is saying, is that you in the West are barbarians, and you've committed barbarian acts much greater than we have committed here in Gaza so far, and so you can't really say anything. But as a point of law, though, he's incorrect that the laws that were brought in after the Second War expressly forbid the moving of populations in this manner and so forth. So they are vulnerable if the ICC, as you mentioned, was following its mandate. To be fair to Karim Khan, nobody at the ICC follows a mandate when it comes to the crimes of Western nations. At least they haven't yet, as far as I'm aware. Has it ever happened?
No, and you're quite right to point that out. And by the way, if there's anything that I agree with when it comes to Benjamin Netanyahu, it's that Western governments have committed acts of horrific barbarism. On that one point, I would be in agreement with the Prime Minister of Israel. But going back to the ICC, it has a sordid record of indifference and cowardice when it comes to the acts of Western war criminals. So we know, for example, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the United States government was engaged in torture. How do we know this? Because when Obama was running to be the president of the United States in 2007 and later became the president for two successive terms, he himself openly acknowledged that waterboarding, which the government of the United States had admitted to having employed in numerous cases was torture. He admitted this. And by the way, the U.S. government engaged in other forms of torture. So you have admissions, Chris, at the highest level of the U.S. government that they committed the war crime of torture all the way back to 2007. Here we are more than 15 years later. Has anybody at the ICC had the spine to indict a single member of the Bush administration, a single CIA official who engaged in torture? Not one. This is a slam dunk, ironclad, ultimately bound to succeed case of a war crime against the U.S. government, and they've done nothing, absolutely nothing. The ICC is a thoroughly discredited institution, and as I've said before, the best thing that we can do for the enforcement of international law is to scrap it, abolish it, and start all over again with an entirely new structure for the enforcement of international law.
Even more, using the American example, in 2001, Alberto Gonzalez, the attorney general in the United States, he came down saying that torture was legal, you know, essentially in a yep. ruling as it pertained to Guantanamo Bay. And these stair-stepping towards codified barbarity, this is what I worry about now. And it seems that as people in high places in our country and others turn a blind eye to what's happening in Israel, what we're actually doing is pushing the goalpost of what it is to be humane and to be human further and further out of our reach. Do you understand what I'm saying? Is that with Gonzalez in 2001 saying, yeah, okay, torture is legal, and Obama in 2008 saying, yeah, we had to torture some folks. Each step of this way creates a more barbarous world, and what's happening in Israel seems to be an extension of that in a most grotesque fashion.
I couldn't agree more, Chris. We're normalizing ever worse forms of savagery in the West, and there is going to be hell to pay for this eventually, because whatever the elites and the mainstream media may be prepared to tolerate is not necessarily reflective of what the people are prepared to tolerate. You know, most people in this world, I'm talking the broader world, not specifically the Western world, most people in this world have a basic sense of human decency, a basic sense of human morality. And they're not going to tolerate, a genocide happening before the eyes of the world in real time. You know, there have been many genocides in the history of humanity, as we all know. I don't remember a single occasion in which a genocide was being broadcast to the world in real time. And the governments of the West were openly supporting the obviously genocidal regime. This is a new level of depravity and barbarism that hasn't been achieved previously in human history, because it's happening openly. It's being broadcast to the world. And Western governments, who for 20 months lectured the whole world about the importance of defending human rights and democracy and international law in Ukraine, all of a sudden turned on a dime and became the sponsors and shameless supporters of an openly genocidal regime. This is firing up the conscience of people everywhere, and I think we've reached an inflection point. I don't say this from a sense of optimism. I don't think I'm being Pollyannish. I sense, you know, having been in many protests, having watched what's happening around the world very closely, that we've reached an inflection point, and people are sick and they're fed up and they're just not going to put up with this anymore. And there are two ways that we can resolve this. There are two ways that we can resolve the tension between the popular outrage at what is being done to the people of Gaza and the depravity of moral of the Israeli government and its Western sponsors. One is they can change their ways, the Western sponsors, and intervene economically and politically, in other words, by peaceful means to stop this, which they completely have the power to do, or this can blow up into a global conflagration with far more devastating consequences than those we've seen thus far in Israel and Palestine and in South Lebanon. That's the choice we confront. And sadly, I think we're going to end up in the latter place, because I see no indication that our depraved leaders in the West are actually going to do the right thing and put a stop to this by peaceful means.
Well, yeah, I've certainly witnessed and feel it myself, too, this heart-sickening, the revulsion of seeing what's going on and the behavior, especially of our own powers, our own governments and authorities to do less than nothing, to actually encourage and profit by it and sell weapons into it and so forth. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dimitri Lascaris. Dimitri's a Montreal-based activist, journalist, and lawyer. He's served as justice critic in the shadow cabinets of the Green Party of Canada and Green Party of Quebec provincially. Dimitri's interviews for TRNN are available at therealnews.com, and his articles appear at various places online, including his own website, dimitrilascaris.org. Well, Dimitri, you were at a manifestation yesterday. Do you want to, in Ottawa, do you want to tell me how that went?
Well, this is, you know, there have been numerous protests in Ottawa. Yesterday we convened, as has happened on several occasions in the last 2 months, on Parliament Hill. I was asked to deliver a speech, and the focus of my speech was the question of genocide. And what I tried to do was to equip the people there with the intellectual tools they need as non-lawyers. You know, it's easy for me as somebody who's practiced law for over 30 years, but people who aren't familiar with the international legal architecture, I wanted to equip people within the space of a 10-minute speech with the basic information they need to rebut the claims by Israeli lobbyists, by Israel advocates and people in Canada who are sympathetic to Israel. Rebut the arguments that Israel isn't committing a genocide, because it plainly is. You know, and I commend, we can't get into that in the limited time available to us, we can't get into that legal question in any real depth. But I commend to people, you know, if you have the moment, a moment, go read Article 2 of the Genocide Convention of 1948, to which Canada, Israel, and the United States are all parties, amongst many other countries. And it should be obvious to you, if you're paying any attention to what is happening on the ground and not confining yourself to Western media, as a layperson, that there is, at the very least, a highly compelling argument that Israel is committing genocide. And I also commend to you Article 1 of the Genocide Convention, which says that all parties have an obligation to prevent and punish acts of genocide. So Canada, as a signatory, it's not only obliged to refrain from committing genocide itself, it also must act preemptively to prevent genocide when there is strong grounds to believe that one is happening, as there is in Gaza. And if you don't believe me, think about the fact that the International Commission of Jurists, a leading organization of 60 seasoned judges, lawyers, and international legal academics, issued a statement a few days ago in which it said that there is a serious risk of genocide occurring in Gaza, and that the Article 1 obligation of the Genocide Convention has been triggered, which means that all Western states must take positive, active measures to prevent a genocide from happening in Gaza. That's where we are, Chris. I think this is a slam dunk. I say that as a lawyer, not as a political activist, not as a politician. As a lawyer, this is a slam dunk case of genocide. And it's astonishing that our governments have done nothing to stop it.
Well, it's obvious that this is what's happening to anybody, even without a legal degree. Naming names, the International Center for Justice for Palestinians, in their action through the legal working group for Canadian accountability to the ICC, they name the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, Minister of Foreign Affairs, Melanie Joly, the Minister of National Revenue, Marie-Claude Bibeau, and Minister of Justice and the Attorney General, Arif Virani. These are all names that are on their list. But if, as you say, the chances of any kind of redress in the ICC, Dimitri, are slim to none, what about the International Court of Justice? What kind of role do they play, or can they play, in bringing to an end this horror?
Well, the General Assembly can effectively trigger the jurisdiction of the ICJ to render a decision, at least on an advisory basis. And one of the tactics available to those in the international legal community and activists around the world is to pressure some government or governments to use their seats within the United Nations General Assembly to trigger a vote an adjudication by the International Court of Justice on the question of whether Israel is committing genocide in Gaza or otherwise violating the laws of war. And there is a strong impetus in that direction. So the problem there we confront is that Israel has already flouted for some 17 years, actually it's almost 20 years now, the 2004 decision of the International Court of Justice declaring Israel's settlements to be unanimously declaring Israel's settlements to be a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. So as much as it would be beneficial and desirable for the ICJ to weigh in on the question of whether Israel is committing genocide or other crimes against humanity in Gaza. And I do think that's important. At the end of the day, it's going to take more than that to put a stop to this. And I think that our best bet is a collective action on a massive and relentless scale. And let's recall, it's easy to get despondent about this, but let's recall that civil society made a huge contribution to the downfall of the Afrikaner apartheid regime in South Africa. And it made a huge contribution to the end of the Vietnam War, the genocidal criminal Vietnam War. We can do this, but we can't do it by being sporadic or half-hearted in our opposition to what is happening. We have to be determined. We have to understand that this is a struggle that will involve significant sacrifice on all our parts, and that we cannot flag, we cannot waver in our determination to bring this to an end. And we have to use all the peaceful tactics at our disposal to do just that.
Well, amongst the charges that the ICJP, the International Center of Justice for Palestinians, brings is the fact that Canada is continuing arms sales to Israel. They are continuing to promote the Lone Soldier program, which is where Canadians are recruited to go and serve in the Israeli military, as well as money going to that country and political encouragement and sustainment in that sense. We don't have a ton of time, Dmitry, but we talked a few months ago in August. You were on a ship going in a slow way this time around as part of the flotilla to Gaza. There's been talk from Turkey, especially, who the Mavi Marmara was a Turkish flagship, and they lost, or not lost, but nine of their Turkish citizens were murdered by Israel back in 2010, and one American Turk as well. So 10 people in all were murdered by the special forces of Israel when they boarded that ship, taking ostensibly taking medical supplies to Gaza, but more trying to be in a symbolic way, break the embargo. Now the Turks are talking about another massive flotilla in association with Sweden and maybe other places. It's kind of up in the air. Are you following that? And what's going on with the Gaza boat?
Well, the Gaza boat's plan was and remains to sail again to Gaza in the summer of next year. The part of the voyage that I participated in this year, where I was on the segment from Oslo to Gothenburg, from Gothenburg to Oslo, was the first half, a two-parted expedition back to Gaza, which was intended to conclude next year. As far as I know, that remains the intention. But of course, you know, that ultimately may be superseded by the horrific events on the ground. You know, and I'll be the first to say, as somebody who's participated as a passenger and journalist twice in the Gaza flotilla, that 2010 taught us that these voyages are largely symbolic, which is to say that the Israeli military will engage in any acts of piracy or other violations of international law that needs to in order to prevent the delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza, particularly when you're dealing with a small group of conscientious citizens who are simply trying to break the blockade. So we didn't really, by the time I participated in the flotilla, there weren't really any illusions about our ability to break the blockade. We were simply trying to focus the world's attention on what was happening on the forgotten people to the forgotten people of Gaza. The world's attention is now transfixed by what is happening to the forgotten people of Gaza. They are no longer forgotten. And if President Erdogan actually had a spine, he has far more power than anybody in the Gaza flotilla, and he would send vessels accompanied by Turkish naval military vessels, but delivering strictly humanitarian aid to Gaza, and challenge the Israelis to put us to intervene militarily and stop the delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza. That's what he would do. But he's not going to do that. I see no indication he's going to do that. And frankly, President Erdogan has proven himself to be nothing but a sanctimonious windbag. You know, unless and until he is prepared to commit the resources of his government, and not simply rhetoric, to helping the people of Gaza, I don't think we have any reason to take the man seriously.
The Americans have their carrier group sitting off the coast right now to, I suppose, to prevent any such thing happening. And but it was interesting to see that Lloyd Austin, the defense minister, the American defense minister, gave a dressing down of sorts to Israel, criticizing what they're doing in Gaza and saying if nothing else, it was a strategic failure. Now we see this is not just in Gaza, in the West Bank too. There's been all manner of atrocities going on there, and they're accelerating. And there is no excuse of Hamas terrorism in that instance. I mean, it seems to me that there maybe by the summer, the Gaza boat might not have a Gaza to go back to.
Sadly, Chris, that's true. I'm true in the sense that there's a risk of that being the case, but I actually think that Israel is ultimately going to lose. I don't think that Israel is going to defeat Hamas. I'm not a supporter of Hamas, but the reality is that Hamas, it has a significant degree of support amongst the Palestinian people for one simple reason, and that is it is the only or at least the most significant organization that has put up meaningful armed resistance to the brutal occupation. The Palestinian Authority is completely sold out. It's failed the Palestinian people. So when Palestinians who are desperate for some measure of justice and freedom look across the political spectrum in their own society, the one organization that stands out in terms of putting up meaningful armed resistance to the occupation is Hamas. And so there's a lot of support for Hamas, particularly now in Palestinian society. And given that that's the case, I don't see how Israel can meaningfully achieve its objective of destroying Hamas. Israel cannot achieve its objective of expelling, you know, all or substantially all of the people of Gaza into the Sinai. That isn't going to happen. And where we're heading, I can't say this often enough, absent Western intervention, economic and political intervention, which would be sufficient to bring an end to this slaughter, there's going to be a massive conflagration in the Middle East. And it's not just peoples of Arabic origin who are going to suffer massively in that conflagration. A lot of Israelis are going to die as well. So even if you're a racist and the only thing you care about are Israeli lives, and you don't care about the lives of Palestinians, you don't care about the lives of Lebanese, you don't care about the lives of Iranians, you should be very concerned about where this is all heading. That's where we're heading. I don't believe that Israel can achieve its objectives. It will, however, cause an unprecedented military conflict in the Middle East, which is going to ultimately have detrimental impacts upon us all.
I don't know where to leave it now. I'm off to the demo today in Victoria and in many other places. Sunday is the day, and we've been holding demos here every Sunday since this began, and still getting several hundreds of people coming out to show solidarity as the weather changes and the story gets older in a sense. But more important by the moment. Thanks a lot for coming on and talking to us today, Dimitri. There's a ton more we could talk about. Of course, go to Dimitri's website, dimitrilascaris.org, to find out more about what he's doing and what he has been doing in these past years. Thanks again, Dimitri.
Take care, Chris, and I commend you for going out. And I ask everybody to continue to participate in these protests. They're very, very important. Don't let anybody convince you otherwise.
And stay tuned, because John Helmer's coming up in the second half. We're going to carry on and talk about this from another point of view, from his specialty in Russia, and again, what's happening with the Turks. Thanks, Dimitri.
Take care, Chris.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.
Chicago. Helsinki.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, in addition to the war crimes being committed by Israel, as noted by a UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, namely, quote, the collective punishment by Israel of Palestinian civilians and unlawful forcible evacuation of civilians, there is too the matter of the material manner in which Israel's crimes are being committed, specifically the materiel allegedly being used by its military that in themselves constitute crimes. Israel has proven its willingness to use internationally banned weapons like white phosphorus in Gaza in past attacks, and photographic evidence reveals it is doing so now. But what of the generationally destructive, depleted uranium weapons? John Helmer is a journalist and author who's spent decades living in and reporting from Russia, principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears. Helmer has too been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism, and served as advisor to governments at the highest levels. Among his many book titles are Skripal in Prison, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Jackal's Wedding, American Power, Arab Revolt, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Sovcom Plot, How Pirates Tried to Capture the Treasure of the Russian Seas and Were Caught Out.